morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Thursday, February 9th, 2006. I'm Chris Andre. Coming right up, the Bureau of Land Management has restored funding for the College of Forestry at OSU. The White House has provided more information on the details of Bush's domestic spying program. And bird flu has turned up in Nigeria. Portland area weather, mostly sunny, highs around 60 to 65 tonight, mostly clear in the evening, then partly cloudy, low 35 to 40.
Regarding Oregon, a federal agency restored funding yesterday for a study that has provided evidence for conservationists opposing the Bush administration's policy of logging after wildfires. The U.S. Bureau of Land Management's decision to lift its suspension of the final three-year grant to Oregon State University came a day after a congressman called for an investigation of the funding cutoff. Representative Jay Inslee, representative from Washington, had asked the Interior Department's Inspector General to examine whether the Bureau was punishing the researchers for their findings. The Bureau's decision came after the university said that it had complied with the grant provisions, barring it from using any of the money to lobby Congress and requiring its researchers to inform a Bureau scientist about plans to publish in a scientific journal. The university study found that salvage logging after a 2002 fire killed naturally regenerated seedlings and increased in the short term the amount of fuel on the ground to feed future fires. The study, published last month in the journal Science, was embraced by environmentalists seeking to defeat a pending salvage bill, a logging bill, backed by the Bush administration.
The Bush administration is calling for the Bonneville Power Administration to reverse its longtime policy of using surplus revenue to lower electricity rates for Northwest consumers. KBOO's Stephanie Potter has more.
The budget proposal just released by the Bush administration contains a provision that BPA revenues over $500,000 would flow to the federal government rather than be used to offset rates. Bob Jenks with the Citizens Utilities Board explains.
Traditionally, Bonneville, if you have a dry winter, Bonneville has to go into the market and buy power. Customers pay for that. And if you have a wet winter, Bonneville has extra power to sell to the market. Customers reap the benefit of that.
Jenks predicted the proposal would result in rate increases for consumers.
That will raise rates. Bonneville rates somewhere around 5% is the projections I've seen. Most utilities in the region have to raise their rates.
Portland General Electric uses BPA electricity for its residential customers, but according to Scott Sims, PG&E spokesman,
it would impact investor-owned utilities like Portland General Electric less than it would publicly owned utilities because we don't use a whole lot of Bonneville power, but we do use about 10% of our power mix, having that come from the Bonneville Power Administration.
Sims said the effect on public utilities would vary. Forestville and McMinnville get the bulk of their power from Bonneville. Others use less.
Well, public utility and municipal utility reliance on Bonneville power ranges from a very small percentage to a very high percentage or 100% of their total consumption. So it would really vary in a case-by-case scenario, and it will really depend on what the ultimate rate increase would be.
Ed Mosey, spokesman for the BPA, says that right now the BPA is enjoying a strong market and prices are about three times what they were a year ago. Mosey explained that these additional revenues would go toward paying down the debt to the Treasury that was borrowed to build the system and gave two reasons for supporting it.
It will reduce costs over time because obviously when you pay down your principal, you don't pay as much interest. And the second thing it will do is allow you to borrow more money when you need it to build new transmission facilities.
Bob Jenks disagrees.
What this is really an attempt to is not to pay down BPA's debt. What it's really designed to do is to improve the balance sheet of the federal budget. What goes into the federal budget to pay down that debt shows up as income. It reduces the deficit, the federal deficit, and therefore makes it easier for the president to push for tax cuts.
The co-chairs of the Northwest Energy Caucus, including Oregon Congressman Peter DeFazio, a Democrat, and Greg Walden, a Republican, also have objections. They said in a letter sent to the White House earlier this week that millions of dollars could be pulled out of the Pacific Northwest economy. to pay a federal debt obligation that is already ahead of schedule for repayment. Jenks says usually the systems are set up so that the ratepayers pay down the debt over the lifetime of the structures so that all the ratepayers pay their fair share.
The debt related to a hydroelectric dam would be financed over 50 years. You can speed that up, but all it means is ratepayers today are paying for something that will benefit customers tomorrow, and the ratepayers tomorrow ought to be paying their share.
Republican and Democratic legislators of Northwest Energy Caucus have already called upon the Bush administration to abandon a provision in its budget proposal for next year that would increase power rates in the Pacific Northwest by 10% or more. Jenks is concerned Bush's proposals could lead to even more increases.
Nobody should assume that that $500 million level will stay there. The next budget will put it to $400 million. At some point, then they're going to come and say, well, wait, why didn't sell you this power at cost? Since you paid down the debt and it now doesn't cost anything, why not sell it to you at market, which Bush proposed a couple years ago, in which case then our rates go up 30-40%.
Jenks also mentioned that Bush's proposals will cut weatherization programs.
So low-income citizens in the Northwest would have less access to help in weatherizing their homes and dealing with the higher bills.
Bob Jenks of the Citizens Utility Board. I'm Stephanie Potter, Cable News.
Longtime political Bend activist Scott Silver announced his candidacy for the U.S. congressional seat held by incumbent Greg Walden Silver. Silver, nationally known for his efforts to end unpopular recreation fee program, filed for candidacy with the Secretary of State on February 6, 2006. Silver's decision to declare his candidacy follows many months of laying the groundwork and assessing his chances for winning the general election. Silver is running as a Democrat in the Republican-leaning to a second congressional district of Oregon. Before facing Walden in the November election, he must first win the Democratic primary, which will be held in May. Silver has been a resident of Deschutes County since 1988 and has been a familiar figure associated with local planning, forest management, and national politics. Silver is the executive director of the nonprofit organization Wild Wilderness. He is married to Wendy Colby, who serves on the executive board of the Women's Research Center of Central Oregon. Their son, Jeremy, is a junior at Summer High School. According to Silver, there's a growing consensus shared by Democrats and Republicans alike that the federal government is unresponsive to the interests and needs of the American people. Silver is concerned that the rapidly growing federal deficit is draining the Treasury of the resources needed to support programs that directly benefit taxpayers.
In one of the newest site fights over Walmart complexes proposed around the state, Cornelia city officials voted narrowly Monday night to change local zoning laws in favor of future construction of a mega store. KBOO's Jim Thompson spoke this week to Jeff Anderson, legislative director of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, who was at the city meeting where the vote was held.
It was very clear that they were talking about Walmart, but no one was using that word except for a few upstarts. Could you explain what that is? It seems like it was a bit of maneuvering going on.
Well, Oregon land use laws provide that if you're looking at rezoning, you look at the merits of the application by itself. So you're really not looking at what potentially would be in the new zone. So in other words, the applicant would like to turn residential lands, zone lands, into commercial. So they're not able to say, well, gee whiz, this is going to be this employer coming in. And so it creates a little bit of confusion because the Oregon land use laws are supposed to take the emotions out of whoever the applicant is. But we believe that Goal 9 under the Land Use Board of Appeals says that any project should weigh in the factoring on the community. And we believe that the applicant, that's being Walmart, is a negative influence on the community in terms of job loss.
Jeff, what was the outcome of the meeting?
Well, the city voted 3-2 to uphold the Planning Commission decision, which grants the permitting of the changes. So we're looking to the follow-up on February 21st when there's another vote that we can influence.
So that there will be opportunity then for public involvement?
The public involvement really at this point will be just people showing up. The public testimony has already been concluded, but they will be voting on February 21st based on testimony from last night's meeting. This is a second chance to slow down or stop this Walmart. So it's very important people show up to the February 21st meeting. And there's a couple ways you could do that. You can access information from the wakeupwalmart.com website, or you can go to www.corneliusfirst.org website, and that would provide links to information on the February 21st meeting.
Do you have anything else that you'd like to add that we have forgotten?
Well, the real scary thing is that Walmart is growing at a rate in this country, the equivalent of every 8 months, a chain the size of Fred Meyer's. And for many of us here in Oregon, we understand how many Fred Meyer's there are, but to think of that chain is replicated every 8 months is just frightening, the effect it does on the economy.
In your estimation, what would be the impact to employment in the area?
Well, we've let it be known just very clearly, retail is a zero-sum game, so if a customer is going to go out and buy a gallon of milk, they're going to buy a gallon of milk. They're not going to buy from a gallon of milk from each store. So any loss of sales from the existing markets would be a loss in hours and wages and frankly, jobs. We believe that a Supercenter Cornelius Walmart would close the doors on Hank's Thriftway, which has been in the community for over 70 years. I mean, they've been a great community partner. They're part of our union. They've been that for many, many, many years, and they pay a family wage. And frankly, they would not be able to compete with Walmart, where they pay 30 to 40% less in wages and benefits.
Thank you, Jeff. For KBOO News, this is Jim Thompson.
And that was Jim Thompson with Jeff Anderson of Wake Up Walmart. Find out more about the issue on the web at www.corneliusfirst.org.
A Canadian national whose father allegedly was an associate of Osama bin Laden was indicted yesterday by a federal grand jury in Boston on charges he supplied the Al-Qaeda terror network with weapons. Abdullah Qadir has been held in Canada on an extradition warrant since his December 17th arrest in Toronto. The indictment alleges Qadir brought AK-47 and mortar rounds, rocket-propelled grenades, and containers of mine components for Al-Qaeda for use against coalition forces in Afghanistan. Qadir is the son of Ahmed Saeed Qadir, an alleged Al-Qaeda financer and friend of bin Laden, the indictment says. Qadir brought the weapons at the request of his Egyptian-born Canadian father, who was killed in 2003 when a Pakistani helicopter fired on a house where he was staying with other senior Al-Qaeda operatives. U.S. Attorney Michael Sullivan announced the indictment in Boston. A Canadian judge in December denied bail for Qadir, saying his alleged terrorist links make him a flight risk. Authorities claim Qadir confessed during his questioning in a Pakistan prison, but his lawyers argued in December that the confessions were derived by torture. Pakistani intelligence officers detained him in Islamabad in October 2004, and he was returned to Canada last December. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police arrested him in the request of the United States.
More than one in every four Oregonians has unsafe mercury levels in their body, according to a new report released yesterday by the Environmental Quality Institute. KBOO's Sheila Whiteside has the story.
Over a quarter of Oregonians have dangerous amounts of mercury in their bodies. That's 6% higher than the national average, according to a new report released today, Wednesday, by the Environmental Quality Institute. The report says eating fish from mercury-contaminated rivers is the leading cause for exposure. Erica Mayhurg with the Sierra Club in Oregon says that's a big problem.
Every day, the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality is permitting facilities to dump heavy metals like mercury into our rivers above state toxicity criteria.
The findings are of particular concern for women because mercury can cause birth defects and other health problems in unborn children. Critics question the validity of the study, saying it's not broad-based enough to get an accurate reading. Mayhurg says the state has to stop allowing industries to dump mercury at levels that exceed state water quality standards in Oregon rivers.
Every day, Oregonians are eating fish from Oregon's rivers, and this is exposing them to mercury.
For KBOO News, I'm Sheila Whiteside.
The White House has been insisting for weeks that it would not reveal details of the National Security Agency's warrantless monitoring of Americans' phone calls and emails. Yesterday, it reversed course and provided a House committee with highly classified information about the operation. The White House has been under pressure from lawmakers who wanted more information about the NSA program. Democrats and many Republicans rejected the administration's contention that they could not be trusted with national security secrets. The shift came the same day Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Arlen Specter announced he's drafting legislation that would require the secretive Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to review the NSA's monitoring program and determine if it is constitutional. Republican Representative Heather Wilson, chairwoman of a House Intelligence Subcommittee that oversees the NSA, broke with the Bush administration. Wilson called for a full review of the program and update the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA. She and others also wanted the full House Intelligence Committee to be briefed on the program's operational details. Although the White House initially promised only information about the legal rationale for surveillance, administration officials broadened the scope yesterday to include more sensitive details about how the program works. When asked what prompted the move to give lawmakers more details, the White House spokeswoman Dana Perino said, "The administration has stated, quote, from the beginning that we will work with members of Congress, and we will continue to do so regarding this vital national security program."
Eight senators were among 200 people who were held in a Capitol parking garage last night after a security sensor indicated the presence of a nerve agent in their office building. Later tests proved negative. The all-clear came 3 hours after an air monitoring sensor indicated a suspicious substance in the attic of the Russell Senate office building. It initially tested positive as a nerve agent.
The White House gave a lukewarm endorsement yesterday to an asbestos bill in the Senate. Senators said they have serious concerns about some parts of the legislation to establish a $140 billion fund for paying victims and ending their lawsuits. The bill's sponsor, Judiciary Committee Arlen Specter, acknowledged there are unresolved problems. The White House said in a written statement that it looks forward to working with Congress to strengthen and improve this important legislation. Topping the list of issues is whether the trust fund financed by asbestos manufacturers, users, and their insurers would be drained by claims. Democrats on the Senate Bill Committee estimated the fund would fall short by $150 billion. Specter refused to list the White House concerns, but said the administration's statement advances the ball.
An evangelical group petitioned yesterday to intervene in a lawsuit by an Air Force Academy graduate who alleges senior officers and cadets illegally imposed Christianity on others at the school. The National Association of Evangelicals wants to intervene to help the Air Force fight the federal lawsuit filed last October. Cadets, watchdog groups, and a former academy chaplain have alleged religious intolerance is widespread at the Colorado Springs school. The Air Force has declined to discuss the lawsuit in any detail. However, last August, it issued guidelines discouraging public prayer at official functions and urging commanders to be sensitive about personal expressions of religious faith. Kyle Fisk, executive administrator for the evangelical group, called the lawsuit an unprecedented attack on religious expression in the military and said it seeks the military's secularization. The organization wants to protect the rights of military chaplains and soldiers who enter into religious discussions with fellow soldiers. The chief plaintiff, Mike Weinstein, who is Jewish, is a 1977 honors graduate of the academy. One of his sons graduated from the school in 2004. Another currently is a junior. He said he's convinced academy leaders are nurturing a culture where evangelical Christians, officers, cadets, chaplains, coaches, and professors bully members of other faiths.
Alabama Governor Bob Riley said yesterday that the 9 church fires in rural Alabama during the past week appeared linked. Investigators are checking out witness reports of two men in a sport utility vehicle near a number of the fires. Authorities have ruled arson in five Baptist Church fires Friday in Bibb County, just south of Birmingham. Four more fires at Baptist churches on Tuesday in western Alabama had similar patterns. Doors kicked in, fires set near the altar. Riley said he has seen no evidence of a grand conspiracy against religion or Baptist churches. Jim Cavanaugh, regional director of the Federal Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives Agency, Explosives Agency, said there could be a thrill motive behind the arsons. Cavanaugh said witnesses on more than one occasion have mentioned seeing two men in a dark SUV near the church fires, but he said some witnesses have mentioned other vehicles and investigators aren't looking solely for a dark SUV. The four churches that burned Tuesday all have black congregations. Four of the five churches set afire Friday have white congregations.
And more from the front lines of America's holy wars. Dozens of leading American evangelicals went public yesterday with a call for their faithful to press the Bush administration into action on climate change. Leif Anderson, pastor of a megachurch in Minneapolis and former president of the National Association of Evangelicals, said, "Whether you believe the Earth began 4,000 years ago or 4 billion years ago, you are still concerned with the consequences of global warming, especially for the poor." 86 influential evangelicals yesterday endorsed an environmental action plan that calls on the Bush administration to impose mandatory limits on the fossil fuel emissions that scientists blame for warmer temperatures. The initiative marks a rare challenge to Bush from one of his most loyal constituencies, his fellow Christians. Bush has refused to acknowledge the dangers caused by burning fossil fuels, and his administration has repeatedly been accused of stifling scientific evidence on the issue of climate change. Yesterday's signatories include the National Commander of the Salvation Army, Todd Bassett, the author of the best-selling The Purpose-Driven Life book, Rick Warren, the editor of Christianity Today, David Neff, and Dwayne Litman, the president of Wheaton College, the leading Christian university.
A NASA public affairs officer who worked on George Bush's re-election campaign and was linked to a campaign to stifle discussion by space agency scientists on global warming has resigned. George Deutsch was given a job in the NASA press office last year after working on Bush's 2004 presidential campaign. He resigned after it emerged that he had not been awarded the journalism degree he claimed on his resume. According to the New York Times, Deutsch had been described as a bit player in a politically motivated campaign to stop scientists from speaking publicly on global warming or giving interviews to the media. Scientists were also ordered to remove a posting from the agency's website, which showed that 2005 was the warmest year on record. He also repeatedly told a web designer to add the word theory at every mention of the Big Bang. The New York Times quoted a NASA source as saying his involvement was part of an intensifying effort at the agency to exert political control over the flow of public information. Deutsch resigned after Texas A&M University said he attended the institution but had not completed the course. In an email last October, Mr. Deutsch wrote, "The theory that the universe was created by a Big Bang is just that, a theory. It is not proven fact, it is opinion. Yes, the scientific community, by and large, may share this opinion, but that doesn't make it correct. It is not NASA's place, nor should it be, to make a declaration such as this about the existence of the universe that discounts intelligent design by a creator," the other half of the argument.
Republicans easily defeated three resolutions seeking information about the Bush administration's policies on torture after a heated committee hearing. Representative Henry Hyde, chairman of the House International Relations Committee, said Democrats who submitted the resolutions should at least silently confess to themselves that their actions pose real dangers to our country. Hyde accused Democrats of playing politics with an eye on November's congressional elections by offering the three resolutions. All three proposed were defeated on almost straight party line votes. The committee's senior Democrat, Representative Tom Lantos of California, denied Hyde's accusations of partisan motivation.
America entered the row over the row over the Mohammed cartoons yesterday, accusing Syria and Iran of stoking up protests against the caricatures to suit their own ends. In France, the publication of all the offending cartoons of a magazine sparked further protests. Condoleezza Rice said, quote, I have no doubt that Iran and Syria have gone out of their way to inflame sentiments and have used this for their own purposes. The world ought to call them on it. Angry demonstrations aimed at European and Western targets showed no signs of abating. In Tehran, protesters pelted the British embassy with stones, even though the British press has refrained from publishing the material. The EU foreign policy chief, Javier Solana, is due to visit Muslim and Arab countries in an effort to build bridges. The cartoons were published in more than 20 countries. In a further development, the Danish editor behind the original publication of the cartoons said he was trying to liaise with an Iranian paper planning to publish cartoons about the Holocaust. President Jacques Chirac of France accused newspapers printing the cartoons of provocation, as well as a cartoon that have prompted fury in the Islamic world. It published other drawings poking fun at different religions. Engineers in Uganda are secretly draining Lake Victoria to generate electricity, according to The Guardian. They're flouting an international agreement to protect the world's second largest freshwater lake. Daniel Call, a hydrologist with the UN's International Strategy for Disaster Reduction in Nairobi, Kenya, said the country is directing more of the lake's waters than agreed 50 years ago under an international pact. Call has calculated that the water level in the lake is almost half a meter lower than it should be. Officials report that hydroelectric dam operations published for March and November last year show that the water releases were almost twice their permitted rates, he says. The report is published by U.S. environmental lobby group International Rivers Network. Frank Muramuzi of Uganda's National Association of Professional Environmentalists told New Scientist magazine, this dam complex is pulling the plug on Lake Victoria. The lake, which covers an area that includes Uganda, Kenya, and Tanzania, supports 30 million people. Water levels have plummeted since 2003 and are now at an 80-year low. There have also been disruptions to electricity supply and the company that operates the dams. McCall says the dams are as much to blame as the drought. If the dams had operated as agreed, the drought would have accounted for only half the water loss. It was agreed that the amount of water flowing through the turbines should mimic the amount that used to drain over the weir.
Romania's president, Traian Băsescu, conceded yesterday that CIA flights may have passed through Romania, but said authorities were not able to determine which American agency was piloting the U.S. planes. Planes belonging to the U.S. government have landed at Mihail Conisu Airport without it being possible for Romanian authorities to identify which agency they were from. The U.S. military withdrew its remaining forces from Romania in June of 2003, asked whether CIA flights had landed in Romania. Băsescu said, I have never rejected this reality, but we reject any allegation that under U.S.-Romanian cooperation, human rights were not respected. Allegations that the CIA hid and interrogated key al-Qaeda suspects in Soviet-era compounds in Eastern Europe were first reported in November of last year. Human Rights Watch also said it had evidence that the CIA had moved suspected terrorists captured in Afghanistan to Poland and Romania.
The EU was yesterday fearing huge compensation claims from the American biotech industry after a ruling suggesting member states had illegally banned imports of genetically modified food. The preliminary World Trade Organization panel ruling indicated that the EU blocked imports of GM produce from the U.S., Canada, and Argentina for 5 years from 1998. Though the allegation ban was lifted in 2004, hundreds of millions of dollars in trade were lost. In response yesterday to European Commission The European Commission said the WTO had vindicated the EC's current regulatory process for handling GM foods, but the powerful U.S. farm lobby has indicated Brussels could face damages claims backdated to 1998. The U.S. argues that the ban of American corn exports to Europe, originally imposed by Australia, France, Germany, Greece, Italy, and Luxembourg, is still in place. Washington trade officials accuse the EU of endless delays over the approval of safe, proven biotech products. The EU officials insist any delays were not excessive. More than 30 GM organisms were approved for marketing after 1992. The EU, meanwhile, was one of the largest importers of GM organisms and derived foods, with its imports of soybean the biggest in the world. This from The Guardian.
The arrival of the deadly H5N1 virus in Africa has been confirmed. World veterinarian experts yesterday raced to help Nigeria attempt to contain a bird flu outbreak in the north of the country. Its appearance on the world's poorest continent has long been feared, given the potential for the disease to spread from infected birds to humans. European authorities are already assessing the risk for migratory birds making the journey north from West Africa this spring, although how big a factor migration is in spreading the disease is disputed. Movements of poultry, traded exotic and other birds and of people are all possible factors. The news of the Nigerian outbreak coincided with fears that bird flu is now spreading through Iraq. The threat remains that the virus will mutate further into something that can easily spread between people and kill millions. This, according to The Guardian.
Do you trust television news? Do you trust?
Okay. Can I ask you a quick question? Yes or no question?
This has been the Cable Morning News for Thursday, February 2nd, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news, Cable's volunteer audio engineers edited the tape, and Cable's intrepid reporters contributed local stories. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director, and Boone Rivas is on the board right now. I'm Carlos Chavez.
And I'm Chris Andre.
We welcome your participation in the AM Newsroom. To volunteer, call us at 503-231-8032, extension 202. Reach us by email at amnews@kabu or drop by the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. The KABU website, www.kabu.fm. We clear the air at 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis, on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR. Be sure to join us at 5 p.m. for a solid hour of news on the KABU Evening News. Portland area weather, mostly sunny, highs around 60 to 65. Tonight, mostly clear in the evening, then partly cloudy, lows 35 to 40. Coming up later this morning at 7:30, Joanne Bowman hosts Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. At 9, Dave Mazza hosts Oregon Notebook with guest Mike Leachman of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. He wrote the Center's State of Working Oregon Report. He has also researched corporate taxes, Oregon tax breaks, hunger, and public assistance programs. At 9:30, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. And it's part three of Destruction of the World Trade Center, a lecture by David Ray Griffith. Griffin, author of The New Pearl Harbor. At 10:30 on Art Focus, Julie Bernard interviews Rebecca Guberman Bloom, whose primary medium is an acrostic painting. At 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. Thank you.
The community calendar for Thursday, February 9th. There will be a panel discussion tonight at 6:30 p.m. called The Role of Higher Education in Community Food Systems. This will be held at the Portland Community College Rock Creek Campus Event Center at 17705 Northwest Springville Road in Portland. Panelists will include representatives from the Governor's Office, Portland State University, New Seasons Market, and others. And then on Friday, February 10th, from 1 to 2:45 p.m., there will be a workshop called Sustainable Campus Food Programs and Curricular Applications. And then from 3 to 4:30 p.m., there will be workshops on learning gardens and student initiatives. Again, this is held at the Portland Community College Rock Creek Campus Event Center. All events are free and open to the public. No advance registration is necessary and parking is free. For more information, contact Jennifer at 503-977-4419. Tazo welcomes submissions for its juried Waste Not art competition, exhibition, and auction to benefit Scrap and Disjecta. Emerging and professional artists, designers, and architects in the Pacific Northwest are invited to create original works of art using a minimum of 75% recycled, reused, and found materials and submit their creations to a selection committee for inclusion in the exhibition and auction. The submission deadline is Monday, February 13th. Selected works will be displayed and auctioned at the event on March 4, 2006. Proceeds from the exhibition's live and silent auction of artwork will be split between the individual artists and the event's beneficiaries, Scrap and Disjecta. Scrap is the School and Community Reuse Action Project, and it promotes creative reuse and environmentally sustainable behavior by providing educational programs and affordable materials to the community. Disjecta is an outlet for artists of all disciplines and provides an art center for emerging concepts in visual and performing arts in the Inner East Side of Portland.
Excellent.
For official rules, submission guidelines, and more information, please visit www.wastenotart.com or contact Amy Bourne at 503-736-9005, extension 2248. If you are a member of a nonprofit or community group and would like to have an upcoming event considered for an announcement on this program, please email kboocommunitycalendar@gmail.com or post to our website at kboo.fm. You've been listening to the Community Calendar for Thursday, February 9th. This is Alicia Olson for KBOO listener-sponsored community radio in Portland, Hood River, and Corvallis.
By KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
Greetings, this is Contessa de la Luna. The Cable Board of Directors will meet this Friday, that's right, this Friday. Support and be an active member listener by attending the Cable Board of Directors meeting this Friday evening at 6 p.m., 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, one half block south of Burnside, darling. Kiss, kiss.
Community College would like to invite you to the 16th Annual African Film Festival honoring Black History Month at PCC's Cascade Campus. This year's festival will feature 28 political, historical, and socially charged films as seen through the eyes of Africans. The films will cover a wide range of themes and topics, from the African legacy in Mexico, women's ongoing struggle for equality and independence, to love across class lines and preservation of African cultural and artistic heritage. This KBOO co-sponsored festival will be free of charge and will cover a five-week period from February 3rd through March 4th. For more information, go to www.africanfilmfestival.org or call 503-244-6111, extension 3630.